accident. A sudden dragonfly or the unexpected revelation of character. And he will play off it, wrongly or rightly. He is inclusive, just as he is broad-shouldered, boisterous in the company of strangers. All this an escape from his secretiveness. He has an openness that grows from having once been a discovering youth. His will is curious, more than ruthless. So he needed a tactical executioner beside him, and he found that ability in Rose. He knows he is not the one they are after, but her, the unseen but regularly heard Viola, the woman intercepting their elusive signals over the airwaves, the voice reporting their movements, betraying their whereabouts. Still, Felon is also a double-sided mirror. Thousands hear him as the genial broadcaster on the Naturalist's Hour, mulling over the weight of an eagle or discussing the origin of the term bolted lettuce, as if he were a neighbor speaking over a shoulder-high fence, unaware of others overhearing him in faraway Derbyshire. Yet to all of them, he is unseen as well as familiar. There has been no photograph of him in the Radio Times, only a pencil sketch of a man striding in the middle distance, far enough away to be unidentifiable. Now and then he may invite a specialist on voles, or a tackle and fly designer into the basement studio of the BBC, and during such times, try to be the humble listener. But his audience prefers it when he speaks for himself. They are accustomed to his roving mind, as when he unearths the John Clare line, where field fares chatter in the whistling thorn, or recites a poem by Thomas Hardy about the devastation to small animals on the 70 or so fields where the Battle of Waterloo was fought. The mole's tunneled chambers are crushed by wheels, the lark's eggs scattered, their owners fled, and the hedgehog's household the sapper unseals. The snail draws in at the terrible tread, but in vain he is crushed by the fellow rim. The worm asks what can be overhead, and wriggles deep from a scene so grim, and guesses him safe. It is his favorite poem. He reads the passage slowly and gently, as if in animal time. The woman behind the glare of the arc light constantly alters the line of questioning to catch him unawares. He has chosen to confess to nothing but unfaithfulness and betrayal, perhaps thinking he might blind her with irritation. He has joked his way through the conversation with her on the other side of the lights, but I wondered, had they put a subtle woman in his path to ask him simple questions, allowing him to believe he is misdirecting her with personal details? But were his fictions revealing to her? She seeks a physical description of the woman they hold responsible. Sometimes her questions are obvious, and they both laugh, he at her trickery, her laugh more thoughtful. Most of the time, even though exhausted, he recognizes the hidden intent in the question. Viola, he repeats, as if bemused when she first brings up the name. And because Viola is a fictitious name, he helps compose a fictional portrait for the interrogators. Viola is modest, he says. Where is she from? From farming country, I believe.
Where?
Not sure. He needs to recapture ground, having perhaps given away too much. South London?
But you said farming country. Essex? Wessex?
Oh, you know Hardy. Who else do you read? He asks.
We know her signature style on the airwaves. But the one time we intercepted her voice, we thought she had a coastal accent we cannot quite place.
South London, I believe, he reiterates.
No, we know it is not that. We have specialists. When did you take on that accent you have?
What on earth do you mean?
Have you always had that way of speaking? A self-made man? Is the difference between you and Viola then to do with class? Because she does not sound like you, does she?
Look, I hardly know the woman at all.
Beautiful?
He laughs. I suppose so. A few moles on her neck.
How much younger than you, do you think?
I don't know her age.
Do you know Denmark Hill? An Oliver Strachey? Long flu knife?
He is quiet, surprised.
Do you know how many of our people were killed by the communist partisans, your new allies, in the Foiba massacres near Trieste? How many hundreds died there, buried in the sinkholes? Do you think?
He says nothing.
Or in my uncle's village?
It is hot, and he is glad when they turn all the lights off for a while. The woman continues speaking in the dark.
So you don't know what happened there, in that village? My uncle's village. Population 400. Now 90. Nearly all of them killed in one night. A child witnessed it. She was awake. And when she spoke of it a day later, the partisans took her out and killed her too.
I wouldn't know.
The woman who calls herself Viola was the radio link between your people and the partisans. She told them where to go that night. And other locations, Rahina Suma and Gekova. She provided them with information. The mileage from the sea, the blocked exits, how to enter.
Whoever she is, he says. She would have just been passing on instructions. She would not have known what was going to happen. She may not even know what happened.
Perhaps, but hers is the only name we have. Not a general or an officer. Just her code name, Viola. No other name.
What happened in those villages? Felon asks in the dark. Though he knows the answer. The large arc light is turned on.
You know what we call it now? Bloody Autumn. When you threw your support behind the partisans to crush the Germans, we were all, Croats, Serbs, Hungarians, Italians, categorized by you as fascists and German sympathizers. Ordinary people were now criminals of war. Some of us had been your allies. Now we were the enemy. A shift of wind in London, some political whisper. So everything changed. Our villages were turned into ground. There's no evidence of them now. People were lined up in front of common graves, bound with wire so they couldn't run. Old feuds, now an excuse for murder. Other villages also erased. In Sivak, in Adjoyan. The partisans always circling closer to Trieste, until they could drive us into the city, where there would be more annihilation. Italians, Slovenes, Yugoslavs, all of them. All of us.
Felon asks, what was the name of that first village? Your uncle's village.
It no longer has a name.
Rose and the soldier were moving fast over the rough terrain, wet from the constant river crossings, hurrying to reach the location before it got dark, uncertain where exactly it was. Just a few more valleys, she thought, and she told the soldier that. Everything was in flux. They could not carry a shortwave radio, only the hastily made identity papers they had been given. The man beside her had a gun. They were searching for a hill, a hut at its base, and they eventually saw the structure an hour later. Their arrival surprised the ones who were there. When Rose and the soldier entered the hut, shivering, their clothes wet, she saw Felon, looking immaculate, fully dry. He was wordless for a moment, then annoyed. "What are you doing?" She waved the question away as if to postpone it. She saw another man and a woman, and they stepped towards her. She knew them. There was a kit bag at Felon's feet, and he gestured with almost comic aloofness, as if providing clothing was his only role in being there. "Use whatever you want, I suppose," he said. "Get dry." And he walked out. They divided the clothes between the two of them. A heavy shirt was taken by the soldier. She took a pair of pajamas and what she knew was Felon's Harris tweed jacket. She had often seen him wear it in London. "What the hell are you doing?" he asked again when she came outside.
"They've taken control of the airwaves, so there's radio silence. You could not be reached, so I came myself. They've been tracking our communiques. They know where you are. I've been sent to tell you, you have to get out."
"This is not safe for you here, Rose."
"None of you are safe. That's the point. They have your names. They know where you're headed. They've got Connolly and Jacobs. They also claim to know who Viola is."
She referred to herself in the third person, as if someone might be listening. "We'll stay the night," he said.
"Why?
Because you have a girl here?" He laughed. "No, because we also just arrived." They ate close to the fire. The talk among them was careful, each uncertain how much the others knew. Each of them had always created a border between themselves and others, so that a destination or purpose would not be exposed if any one of them was caught. No one else here knew she was Viola, or that the man she was traveling with was her bodyguard. Her soldier was shy, as she discovered in her attempts at conversation on their sudden 2-day journey, even when she asked him where he had grown up. He had no idea what her mission was, just that she was a woman he had to safeguard. When she and Felon stepped outside again to talk after the meal, the soldier came too. And she asked him to move away, so she and Felon could speak privately. He walked off and lit a cigarette in the distance, and she watched the faint pulse of it over Felon's shoulder whenever he inhaled. They could hear the others laughing inside. "Why?" Felon said with a tired sigh of judgment. It was almost not a question. "It didn't have to be you."
"You would not have listened to anyone else. And you know too much. Everyone's at risk if you're caught. We're without rules of war now. You'd be interrogated as a spy, then you'd disappear. We're not much better than terrorists these days."
She said it bitterly. Felon said nothing, trying to find a weapon, some utensil, to get back into the argument. She reached out and put her hand on him, and they stood very still in the dark. A faint light from the fire inside the hut flickered on his shoulders. Everything seemed peaceful, still, as when, during a long-ago evening in Suffolk, a barn owl, white with a huge head, had floated silently to the earth near them, picked up a small animal, a rodent or a shrew, as if a piece of litter on the lawn, and glided up into a dark tree without breaking the arc of movement. "If you come upon their nests," he told her then, "you'll find they eat everything. The head of a rabbit, the remnants of a bat, a meadowlark. They're powerful. Their wingspan, you just saw it. What is it? Almost 4 feet. Yet if you ever get to hold one, there is no weight at all behind the strength."
"How did you get to hold one?"
One of my brothers found a barn owl. It had been electrocuted. He passed it over to me. It was large with its beautiful range of feathers, as if scalloped, yet it weighed nothing at all. When he put it in my hands lifted, because there wasn't the resistance I was expecting. Are you warm enough, Rose? Shall we go in? When he spoke to her now, suddenly in the present, she had to remember where she was, outside a hut, somewhere near Naples. Inside, the fire was nearly out. She rolled herself into a blanket and lay there. She could hear the others adapting themselves to comfortable positions. She had mentioned to Felon that she was confused about the location, and he'd quickly sketched a map on a loose sheet of paper to clarify where they were. So her mind was racing over the drawn landscape, stretching away from this hut till it reached their two possible escape routes. One of them, a harbor, where she had to contact a person named Carmen if things went wrong. She could smell the steam from their wet clothes by the fire, and Felon's jacket was rough against her body. There was whispering. The previous year, working with him, she suspected he was involved with Hardwick, the other woman in the hut. Now she could make out muffled talk and movement in the corner of the room where he had bedded down. She forced her mind back to the landscape and imagined the journey ahead with her bodyguard. When she woke, it was first light. Rising early was another remnant of her education with Felon, from the times they used to go wildfowling or hiking along a river to fish. She sat up and looked towards the darker end of the hut, and saw Felon watching her, his companion asleep next to him. She rolled out of the blanket, gathered her dry clothes, and went outside to dress in private. A minute later, the bodyguard discreetly followed her. Felon was up and the rest were awake when she came back in. She went over and gave him back his jacket. She had felt the heaviness of it against her all night. During their quick breakfast, he was courteous with her, as if she, not he, were the authority in the group. It had begun earlier, when his eyes watched her from across the hut, while she imagined him in the shadow of his involvement with the other woman. It would be a few days later that Felon was captured and interrogated, just as she had warned him.
You are a married man, are you not?
Yes, he lies.
I think you're good with women. Was she your lover?
Met her just once.
Was she married? Children?
I really don't know.
What was it made her attractive? Her youth?
I wouldn't know, he shrugs. Perhaps her gait.
What is gait?
A way of walking, the way one walks. You know people by their gait.
You like gait in women?
Yes. Yes, I do. That's really all I remember about her.
There must have been something else. Her hair?
Red. He is pleased with his quick fiction, though perhaps he has been too quick.
When you said mole a while ago, I thought you meant like the animals.
Ha!
Yes, you confused me. What is it exactly?
Oh, you know, they're like birthmarks on skin.
Ah, one or two birthmarks?
I didn't count them, he says quietly.
I don't believe the red hair, she says.
By now Rose would be in Naples, Felon thinks. Safe.
Also, I think she is very attractive.
The woman laughs.
Otherwise you wouldn't avoid admitting it.
They let him go then, rather to his surprise. It is not him they are after, And by then they have located and identified Viola with his help. The Street of Small Daggers. She wakes, her face against the word Aquedotto, a burning pain in her arm, her mind scrambling to know where she is, the hour. Instead, she remembers another time, hearing a cicada. It had been 6 in the evening then, and she'd woken to find herself lying on grass, almost the same position she is in now, her cheek against her upper arm. She'd been fully aware of her senses then. All that was wrong with her that time was tiredness. She had walked many miles into the town to meet Felon, and having to wait a few hours, found a small park beside a footpath and slept, then woke suddenly to hear the mournful cicada. But at first, similarly, she had been unaware of what she was doing there. She had been waiting that time for him in a small park. Confusing her now is the word aquedotto, meaning a path for water, a drain. She raises her head off the drain cover. She needs clarity, to know why she is here like this, needs to think. She sees the range of still wet cuts on her arm. If there is something voicing itself mournfully now, it is in her. She holds up her wrist, wipes blood off her broken watch, a star of glass. It says it is 5 or 6, early in the morning. She looks at the sky. She begins to remember, slowly. She needs to reach a safe house. There is a woman named Carmen she must make contact with, in case she needs help. Rose stands, raises a fold of the dark skirt, holds it in her teeth, and rips the lower third off with her good hand, so she can bandage her arm tightly against the pain. Then crouches, breathing heavily. Now downhill to the harbor to find Carmen, wherever she is, and get to a boat. There are always miracles here, they say about Naples. She leaves the Street of the Small Daggers and recovers the map in her head. Posilipo is the name for the rich part of the city, meaning break from sorrow, a Greek word still used in Italy. And she needs to get to the Sparca Napoli, the street that splits the city in two. She moves downhill repeating the names, Sparca Napoli and Posilipo. The racket of seagulls is loud, meaning water. Find Carmen, then the harbor. There's light in the sky now. But what is most alive is her left arm, where the pain is, the bandage already heavy with blood. She remembers now the small knives they used on her. They had discovered her and the soldier after the group separated to take different routes out of the country. How? Who gave something away? As she had entered the outskirts of the city, they identified her, killed the soldier. He was just a boy. In some building, they began cutting open her arm with each question. After an hour, they stopped, left her. She must have somehow got away, crawled onto the street. They would be looking for her. Were they finished with her? Now she is walking downhill, thinking, her senses returning. A break from sorrow. A rest from grief. What is Tumbiro? She turns a corner and realizes she has stumbled awkwardly into a brightly lit square. This was the light in the sky all the time, not the dawn, but families and other groups surrounding a bar, eating and drinking in the night air. A 10-year-old girl singing in their midst. It is a familiar song, one she sang to her son years before in another language. The scene in front of her could be any evening hour, but it is not early morning. Her watch must have stopped earlier when they interrogated her, The watch said 5 or 6, but it meant late afternoon, not the hour before dawn. It must still be before midnight. But the seagulls, were they attracted only to the light in this crowded square? She leans against a table, a stranger watching them talk and laugh, while the girl on a woman's lap sings. It feels medieval, the kind of canvas of a master Felon loved to describe, pointing out its hidden structures, how a crowd radiates out and fills the canvas from something as small as a loaf of bread, which gives it all an anchor. That is how the world interacts, he would say. Here, for her, the loaf of bread is the small girl singing with private joy. It is how she herself feels, having come into this loud gathering by following the Sparca Napoli towards where she is supposed to find Carmen. She could take one step forward and be more exposed, but instead she pulls out a chair and sits, resting her wounded arm on the table, the continuous mural around her. She's not lived such a life, of families and community, for a very long time. She has accepted a world of secretiveness, where there is a different power, where there is no generosity. A woman behind her places her hands gently on her shoulders.
There are always miracles here,
the woman says to her. Some months later, Felon walks with Rose, as he had once promised they would, into the Bibliothèque Mazarine. They have lunched at La Coupole long into the afternoon, watching each other swallow oysters, drink champagne from slender flutes, until they finish their meal with a crepe they share. When she reaches out for a fork, he sees the scar above her wrist.
A toast, she says. Our war is over.
Felon doesn't raise his glass. And the next war, you will go back to England, and I shall stay here. Wars are never over. Seville to wound, Cordoba to die in. Remember? In a taxi, dizzy, she will lean against him. Where are they going? They swerve onto the Boulevard Raspail, then the Quai de Conti. She is full of uncertain senses, tethered still to this man, guided by him. The past hours have slid into each other unaccountably. She has woken alone across her bed so wide, she believed she was drifting on a raft. Just as at La Coupole this afternoon, the 100 or so empty tables spread in front of her like an abandoned city. He puts his hand on her shoulder as they walk into the brown building, the great library of Mazarin, who, he announces, was the default ruler of France after Richelieu's demise. Only Felon, she believes, would use the word demise so unconsciously. This man with barely an education before the age of 16. The word from a secondary vocabulary he memorized, just as he retrained his own handwriting away from the coarse script she'd seen in his childhood notebooks, beside those precisely sketched mollusks and lizards he would draw from the natural world. A self-made man, an arriviste, therefore not trusted as authentic by some in the trade, not even himself. Entering the bibliothèque, Rose realizes she is, well, vaguely drunk. Her mind drifts from the sentences he is speaking. 3 flutes of champagne in the early afternoon, anchored by the weight of 9 oysters. And now they have somehow entered the 15th century, with 1,000 or so remnants confiscated from monasteries or surrendered by overthrown aristocracies, even incunabula from the infancy of printing. All of it gathered and protected here after once being damned and therefore hidden for generations. This is the great afterlife, Felon tells her. On an upper floor, he watches her silhouette move against the luminous windows of the building, as if she were being passed by a lit train. Then she is standing in front of a great map of France, with its thousand churches, just as he once imagined she would. So this feels like it is a replica of an earlier desire in him. Those maps, always oppressive with faith, as if the only purpose in life was to journey from one church altar to another, rather than cross the meticulous blue of a river to reach a distant friend. He prefers older maps that are cityless, marked only by contour lines, so they can even now be used for accurate reconnaissance. Felon stands beside a gathering of marble scholars and philosophers, turning quickly as if he might catch a look or a thought in them. He loves the permanent judgment on the faces of statues, their clear weakness or deviousness. In Naples, he stood before a brutal emperor, and he remembers still how the eyes in that evasive stone face never met his, no matter how much he moved from side to side in order to catch his attention. There are times he feels he has become that man. Rose prods him with her fingers, and he turns to her. They walk beside a row of antique desks, each lit with its own amber light. One reveals the hurried handwriting of a saint, another that of one executed in his youth. A chair holds Montaigne's folded jacket. Rose inhales everything. It feels like the continuation of their meal, the taste of oyster suddenly alongside the smell of desk varnish and ancient paper, porous in the air. She has barely spoken since arriving here, and when he points out a detail, she does not respond, eager to discover only what this means for herself. She has adored this man all her life, but feels the clash of herself against this ancient place. This is the great afterlife, just as she perhaps is his. Did he always see her this way? She's drunk with this small perception. She ignores a light rain as she walks the city alone, having slipped his leash. When she loses her way, she does not ask for directions, intent on uncertainty, laughing as she passes the same fountain twice. She wants accident, freedom. She has been brought into this city for a seduction. She can imagine everything, how it will occur. His clearly visible ribs that she will lean her head against, her hand on the fur of his belly, rising with the twitch of it. Her mouth open with praise and kindness as he turns, enters her. She crosses a bridge. It is 4 in the morning when she comes back to her room. She wakes at first light and walks into his adjoining room. Felon is asleep in the more modest bed he has chosen. He insisted when they arrived that she take the grander room. He is on his back, eyes shut, hands at his sides, as if praying or tied to a mast. She draws back the high, heavy curtains, so the room fills with wintry light and furniture, but he does not wake. She watches him, conscious of him now in some other world, perhaps as the uncertain boy he was in his teens. She has never met Felon as an uncertain person. It is the remade man she knows. He has shown her over the years the great vistas she desired. But she thinks now that perhaps the truth of what is before you is clear only to those who lack certainty. She moves through the brocaded room of the hotel. She has not taken her eyes off him, as if they are in the middle of a mimed conversation they have never had. There has been this long twinned story between them, and she is no longer sure how to remain still allied to him. A Paris hotel. She will remember the name always, or perhaps she will need to forget it. In the bathroom, she washes her face to clear her thoughts. She sits on the edge of the bathtub. If she has imagined his courtship of her, she has also imagined hers. She returns to his room, watching for any small movement in him, in case this is false sleep. Pauses, realizes that if she leaves now, she will never be sure. Slips off her shoes and moves forward. Lowers herself onto the bed and stretches out beside him. My ally, she thinks. She remembers small particles of their history she will never be able to let go of. Some forgotten whisper of confidence, some grip of his hand, a recognition across a room, him dancing with an animal in a field, how he learned to speak clearly and slowly on the naturalist's hour, so his near-deaf mother could understand him during those Saturday afternoons. How he knotted and bit the fine nylon when he completed that blue-winged olive nymph. When she was 8, when he was 16. That was only the first layer. There were more private depths. Him lighting a stove in a cold, dark cottage. The almost silent notes of a cricket. Then later, him in a hut in Europe, standing up, leaving Hardwick asleep on the hut floor. All the scars on her arm he has not seen. She rolls onto her side to look at his face. Then she will leave. This is where you are, she thinks. So much left unburied at the end of a war. My mother returns to the house, built in an earlier century, which still signaled its presence over the fields. This had never been a hidden place. You could make out its whiteness almost a mile away as you listened to the rustle of pines surrounding you. But the house itself was always silent, a fold in the valley protecting it. A place of solitude, with water meadows sloping to the river, and where if you stepped outside on a Sunday, you might still hear the bell from a Norman church miles away. Rose's most insignificant confession to me during our last days together may have been the most revealing. It was about this house she had inherited. She ought to have chosen a different landscape, she said. Her wish for disinheritance or exile had been proclaimed years earlier, when she separated herself from her parents, hiding from them what she was doing during the war, and becoming unknown even to her children. Now her return to white paint was, I assumed, what she wanted. But it was an old house. She knew each slight incline of hall, every stiff window casing, the noise of winds during different seasons. She could have walked blindfolded through its rooms into the garden, and stopped with assurance an inch from a lilac. She knew where the moon hung each month, as well as which window to view it from. It was her biography since birth, her biology. I think it drove her mad. She accepted it not just as safety or assurance, but as fate. Even that loud noise from the wooden floor, and the realization of this shook me. It was built in the 1830s. She would open a door and find herself in her grandmother's life. She could witness the generations of women in their labors with her husband's visit now and then, and child after child, cry after cry, wood fire after wood fire, the banister smoothed from 100 years of touch. Years later, I would come across a similar awareness in the work of a French writer. I thought about it some nights till it almost hurt, saw myself preceded by all those women in the same bedrooms, the same twilight. She had witnessed her mother in such a role when her father was at sea, or in London returning only on weekends. This was the inheritance she had come back to, the prior life she had run from. She was once more back in a small repeating universe that included few outsiders. A family of Thatchers working on the roof, the postman, or Mr. Malachite arriving with sketches for the greenhouse he was building. I asked my mother, it was probably the most personal question I asked her, "Do you see yourself in me at all?"
"No."
"Or do you think I might be like you?"
"That is, of course, a different question."
"I'm not sure. Perhaps it's the same."
"No, it isn't. I suspect there might be a similarity and connection. I'm distrustful, not open. That may be true of you, now."
She'd gone way beyond what I was considering. I was thinking of something such as courtesy or table manners, though her present solitary life had not made her courteous. She had little interest in what others were up to, as long as they left her alone. As for table manners, she'd shaved the consumption of meals down to an aerodynamic minimum. One plate, one glass, with the table wiped clean 10 seconds after the roughly 6-minute meal was over. Her daily path through the house was so ingrained a habit, she was unaware of it unless it was interrupted. A conversation with Sam Malachite, or a long walk into the hills while I was working with him. She felt protected by what she believed was her total insignificance and anonymity to those in the village, while within the house there was the nightingale floor, that landmine of noises which would signal any intruder entering her territory. Her nightingale in the sycamore. But that eventual stranger, she expected, never stepped indoors.
"Anyway, why?"
She now insisted on continuing our small conversation.
"What were you thinking could have been the same between the two of us?"
"Nothing," I said, smiling. "I thought perhaps table manners, or some other recognizable habit." She was surprised.
"Well, my parents always said, as everyone's parents probably did, someday you may be eating with the king, so watch your manners."
Why had my mother chosen to alight on just those two thin branches she saw as questionable skills or weaknesses in herself? Distrustful and not open. I understand now how she might have needed to learn those qualities in order to protect herself in her work, as well as in her marriage to a destructive and disappearing man. So she broke out from her chrysalis and slipped away to work with Marsh Fellon, who had broadcast those seeds of temptation when she was young. His was the faultless campaign of a gatherer. He had waited, drawing her into the service in much the same way he himself had been drawn in, almost innocently. Because what she wanted, I suspect, was a world she could fully participate in, even if it meant not being fully and safely loved.
"Oh, I don't want to be just worshipped,"
as Olive Lawrence had announced once to Rachel and me. We never know more than the surface of any relationship after a certain stage. Just as those layers of chalk, built from the efforts of infinitesimal creatures, work in almost limitless time. It is easier to understand the mercurial, unreliable relationship that existed between Rose and Marsh Fellon. As for the story of my mother and her husband, that ghost in her story, I have only the image of him sitting in that uncomfortable iron chair in our garden, lying about why he was leaving us. I had wanted to ask her if she saw my father in me at all, or if she thought I might be like him. It was to be my last summer with Sam Malachite. We were laughing, and he leaned back on his heels and watched me.
"Well, you have changed," You barely spoke the first season you worked with me.
I was shy, I said.
No, you were quiet, he said, being more aware and conscious of what I had been than I was. You have a quiet heart.
Now and then, in an uninterested way, my mother asked how my work with Mr. Malachite was going. Was it at all difficult? Well, there was no schwer, I replied, and caught a rueful smile on her face. Walter, she murmured. So it was something he must often have said, even to her. I took a breath. What happened to Walter? A quietness. Then, what did you say you two called him? She threw the book she was reading onto the table. The moth. She'd lost the wry smile I had witnessed seconds earlier. Was there even a cat? I asked. Her eyes startled. Yes. Walter told me about your talk. Why did you not remember the cat? I bury things. What exactly happened to Walter? He died protecting you both that night at the bark. The way he protected you when you were small. That time you ran away after your father killed your cat. Why were we not told he was protecting us? Your sister realized. It is why she will never forgive me his death. I suppose he was the true father to her, and he loved her. Do you mean he was in love with her? No. He was just a man without children, who loved children. He wanted you safe. I didn't feel safe. Did you know that? She shook her head. I think Rachel felt safe with him. I know you felt safe with him as a small boy. I stood up. But why were we not told he was protecting us? Roman history, Nathaniel. You need to read it. It is full of emperors who cannot tell even their children what catastrophe is about to occur, so they might defend themselves. Sometimes there is a necessity for silence. I grew up with your silence. You know I leave soon, and I won't see you until Christmas. This could be our last talk for a while. I know, dear Nathaniel. It was September when I began college. Goodbye, goodbye. There was no embrace. I knew that every day she would at some point climb into the hills and, reaching a crest, look back at her house, tucked safely into its fold of earth. Half a mile away would be the thankful village. She'd be at a great height, as Felon had taught her. A tall, lean woman coasting the hills, almost certain of her defenses. When he comes, he will be like an Englishman, she had written. But the person who came for Rose Williams was a young woman, somebody's heir. This is, I now tell myself, how it happened. Our mother never went into the village, but the villagers knew where Rose Williams lived, and the woman had come straight to White Paint, dressed as a cross-country runner, no props or disguises. Even that might have been obvious to my mother. But it was a dark October evening, and it was too late when she made out the woman's pale oval face through the condensation of the greenhouse window. She was standing there, still. Then broke the pane with her right elbow. She's left-handed, my mother must have thought to herself. You are Viola? My name is Rose, dear, she said. Viola! Are you Viola? Yes.
It must have felt no worse than all the possibilities of death she had imagined, even dreamt about. Quick and fatal. As if it was finally an ending of feuds, of a war. Perhaps allowing a redeeming. That is what I think now. The greenhouse was humid, and with the broken pane there was a breeze. The young woman fired again to make sure. And then she was running like a harrier over the fields, as if she were my mother's soul leaving her body. The way my mother herself had fled this house at the age of 18 to go to university in order to study languages and meet my father during her second year, give up the idea of law school, have two children, and then flee us as well. A walled garden. A year ago, I came across a book by Olive Lawrence in our local store. And that afternoon, while I set up a humming twine to scare the scavenger birds in the garden, I kept waiting for evening so I could read it without interruption. Apparently it was the basis of a forthcoming television documentary, and so the next day I went out and bought a television set. Such an object has never been part of my life, and when it arrived, it was a surreal guest in the Malachite's small living room. It was as if I had suddenly decided to buy a boat or a seersucker suit. I watched the program, unable at first to compare the Olive Lawrence I saw on the box to the one I'd known as a teenager. To be truthful, I no longer remembered what she looked like. She had been mostly a presence for me. I remembered how she moved, as well as the no-nonsense clothes she wore, even when arriving for a night out with the data. As for her face, the one I saw speaking to me now had the same enthusiasm, and this quickly became the face I attached to my earlier memories of her. Now she was clambering up a rock face in Jordan, now rappelling down while still addressing the camera. Once again I was being offered specific wisdoms about water tables, the varieties of hail across the European landmass, how leafcutter ants could destroy whole forests. All this data about the complex balance of nature was being handed with clarifying ease to us in that same small female palm of hers. I had been right. She could have knitted together my life wisely, not avoiding the complexity of distant rivalries or losses that were unknown to me, in much the way she was able to recognize a tempest preparing itself, or the way she had recognized Rachel's epilepsy by some gesture or quiet evasion in her. I had benefited from the clarity of female opinion in this person who had no close connection to me. In the brief time I knew her, I believed Olive Lawrence was on my side. I stood there and was perceived. I read her book, watched the documentary, in which she hiked across ravaged olive orchards in Palestine, stepped on and off Mongolian trains, bent over and diagrammed the figure-eight path of the lunar sky on a dusty street using walnuts and an orange. She was unchanged, still constantly new. A long time after my mother told me of Olive's war work, I'd read the terse official reports of how scientists recorded wind speeds preparing for D-Day, and how she and others had risen into a dark sky, infested with other gliders that shuddered in the air, brittle as glass, in order to listen to how porous the wind was and search for rainless light, so they could postpone or confirm the invasion. The weather journals she had shown me and my sister, full of medieval woodcuts depicting varieties of hail, or sketches of Saussure's cyanometer, which distinguished the various blues in the sky, were never just theoretical to her. She and others must have felt like magicians at that moment, conjuring up what generations of science had taught them. Olive was the first to reappear out from that half-buried era when we all had met at Ruvigny Gardens. As for the data, I still had no clue as to where he lived. It was years since I had seen him, and I could not even remember his real name. He and the moth and the others existed now only in that ravine of childhood. While my adult life had been spent mostly in a government building, attempting to trace the career my mother had taken. Now and then there would be days in the archives when I'd come across information from distant events that overlapped with my mother's activities. I would, in this way, glimpse details of another operation or place. And so one afternoon, following a tangent to her activities, I came upon references to the transportation of nitroglycerin during the war, how it was transported secretly across the city of London, and, because it was dangerous freight, how this needed to be done at night, with the public unaware. This had continued even during the Blitz, when there was just war light, the river dark, save for one dimmed orange light on bridges to mark the working arch for water traffic, a quiet signal in the midst of the bombing, and the barges ablaze, and shrapnel frapping across the water, while on the blacked-out roads the secret lorries crossed the city 3 or 4 times a night. It was a 30-mile journey from Waltham Abbey, where the great nitrator produced nitroglycerin, to an unnamed underground location in the heart of the city, which turned out to be on Lower Thames Street. Sometimes a floor gives way, and a tunnel below leads to an old destination. Barely pausing, I made my way to the large room of hanging maps. I pulled down various charts, searching out possible routes the nitro trucks might have taken. I knew, almost before my hand traced their path, the indelible names. Sewardstone Street, Cobbinsbrook Bridge, a jog west from the graveyard, then south, until it reached Lower Thames Street. The night route I used to take with the data, when I was a youth, after the war was over. My long-forgotten data, that smuggler, a minor criminal, had possibly been a hero of sorts, for the activity was dangerous work. What he'd done after the war was just a consequence of the peace. That familiar false modesty of the English, which included absurd secrecy or the cliché of an innocent boffin, somewhat like those carefully painted formal dioramas that hid the truth and closed the door on their private selves, it had concealed in some ways the most remarkable theatrical performance of any European nation. Along with undercover agents who included great aunts, semi-competent novelists, a society couturier who'd been a spy in Europe, the designers and builders of false bridges on the Thames that were meant to confuse German bombers who attempted to follow the river into the heart of London, chemists who became specialists on poisons, village crofters on the East Coast who were given lists of German sympathizers to be killed if and when the invasion came, and ornithologists and beekeepers from Kew, as well as permanent bachelors well-versed in the Levant and a handful of languages, one of whom turned out to be Arthur McCash, who continued in the service most of his life. All of them abiding by the secrecy of their roles, even when the war was over, and receiving only, years later, a quiet sentence in an obituary that mentioned they had served with distinction in the Foreign Office. It was nearly always a wet, pitch-black universe when the data drove the cumbersome nitroglycerin lorries, passing gardens with their Anderson shelters, his left hand at the gears, shifting them in the dark, aiming the missile-like vehicle towards a warehouse in London. It was 2 in the morning. There was the map in his head, so he could travel at ridiculous speeds through the night. I spent the afternoon with these discovered dossiers, learning about the make of the lorries, the weight of the nitro transported on each journey, how during the night certain streets had muted blue lights to discreetly illuminate a sudden turn. For most of his life, the data's careers had been camouflaged, unknown to others. The illegal boxing rings in Pimlico, the dog tracks, the smuggling. But in his wartime career, he had been watched and fully known. He needed to